Shopify grows your business no matter how far or big you grow. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. Whether you're selling your fans' next favorite shirt or an exclusive piece of podcast merch, Shopify helps you sell everywhere. Shopify powers 10% of all e-commerce in the U.S. Allbirds, Rothy's, Brooklinen, and millions of other entrepreneurs of every size across 175 countries. Plus, Shopify's award-winning help is there to support your success every step of the way. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/income, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/income now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in.
Welcome to the Professional Book Nerds Podcast presented by Overdrive. This is Joe. Hi, hello. Friends, we're in June. It's Pride Month. It's Audiobook Appreciation Month. I am living my best life. So today I am getting to talk to another amazing and prolific narrator. Last week you heard us talk to Julia Whalen. This week you get to hear me talk to Robin Miles. Before we dive into our interview today, please make sure you rate, review, and subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. Engage with us on social media at Pro Book Nerds. And of course, feel free to reach out with questions, suggestions, and recommendations. You can send those to our email address, professionalbooknerds@overdrive.com. And with that, let's get into my interview with Robin Miles. My guest today is a Golden Voice audiobook narrator, the 2014 Voice of Choice, and is a director, teacher, wisdom seeker, Mysore yoga gal, and mom who is squeezing every drop from the juice of life. It's Robin Miles. Hello.
Hey there, Joe. How are you?
Oh, I'm wonderful. Thank you for joining me today.
Oh, it's my pleasure. I'm really glad to be here.
I'm so glad to have you here. Now, our listeners know it's audiobook month, and to be able to talk to you today, a person who has narrated so many audiobooks. Do you know how many audiobooks you've narrated?
I'm embarrassed to say I think I've lost count at about 450. Yeah, just about. And I'm not even sure if I've counted the ones I've done under a pseudonym. I'm not even sure.
You know, that's okay. That sounds right. When I searched your name through our Overdrive database, I think it hit something over 450 results. And right, that also wouldn't account for any of those pseudonyms or anything like that. So just a few.
Just a few. Yeah, I sit in a booth, I talk, and then we sell it, you know.
You know, just the simple things, right?
You got it.
Now, your most recent book, or at least kind of the one that brings us together today, is The Personal Librarian.
Yes.
Do you have a second to talk about The Personal Librarian, just a little bit of the book itself?
I do. The story, and even before I start, I have to say, The Personal Librarian was written by a writing team, Marie Benedict and Victoria Christopher Murray. Mm-hmm. And I have this habit of, as I start a book, the first thing I do is I read the acknowledgments. I read the last page, you know, and the thank yous, just because that's typically, or there may be a section up front where it's, you know, the preamble.
Of course.
And the way these two women came together to work on this book, I want to read that book too.
Without a doubt.
They had this scholarly interest and incredible amounts of ability as writers, and they tag teamed it. And what they came up with was amazing. I love historical fiction. It's probably that and speculative fiction, I'd say, are like my two favorite genres. And the story of Belle de Costa Green is literally ripped out of the pages of history. And I mean, her father was the first African-American to graduate from Harvard. There is a lot of this. It seems to be in the collective consciousness right now, this going back and trying to fill in the blanks of history. This was a
Yes.
whopper blank. It was a whopper blank.
It
And
really was.
so, wow. It was so exciting to find out how she navigated different things. Gender and race both being such an intersectional thing. She became this incredible power broker, here and in Europe. And yeah, I know she had JP Morgan's money behind her, so it's kind of hard to fail at that point. But getting to that, earning the trust, earning the way in, and then following through. Once you have the power, you still have to follow through on it, on all the acquisitions, on all the bidding, and all the negotiations. She
Right.
was hella slick.
Yes, she was.
She was hella slick.
Well, what's your process like? How do you get started with any book?
Well, I will say I have a particular love, and I got lucky on this, particular love for this sort of era and period. I would
Okay.
say late, and it was the time when my grandfather was alive and in his heyday.
Oh.
My grandparents, they emigrated here from Jamaica, probably around 1919, something like that.
Okay.
But he was born in 1860. I think that's right. I just, it seems, have done a lot that crosses through the 19 teens into maybe like the 1940s, and then also back a little bit into like the 1860s, 70s. So this is a chunk that I keep traveling across. It's a piece of ground I've traveled across.
Okay.
The first thing I do is sort of get an idea of where their speech might be grounded. And for Belle DaCosta Green, between Washington, D.C., where she was born, and New York City, and in a highly, highly educated realm, I go back to an earlier form of speech. Anything that we have that was recorded, is sort of in my mind. And so the vowels were plummier, and we had this intermediate A sound. You had a father. You didn't have a father. It's somewhere between ah and ah. It's the same
Okay.
thing when you hear an Irish person say, my father. It's not my father. It's not my father. It's right in between. So that's one of the first things I do is I kind of slot back that in because it's a sound that's been lost. We don't use it anymore. Same thing with the aw sound in automatic and automobile. And in New York, it's automatic and automobile. You can really hear it. But
Absolutely.
we've taken a page out of like the Chicago Midwestern region. It's sort of It came up and spread out across the country. Now you hear automobile and on and off, automobile, right? And
Yeah.
law. I go to law school instead of law school.
You
You hear
really
it?
hear the Midwestern notes in those.
Right. Well, that's kind of become the dominant sound. You hear it all over the East Coast now too. And so I put that back in too because it's from an earlier period in the US. So that's kind of the first thing I do. There are 7 points of good speech in Edith Skinner's Speak with Distinction that theater artists have used for decades in film and television. And again, they harken back to an earlier era. She wrote that book, I think, in the 70s, maybe the 80s, and she was already
Okay.
an adult herself. And so that also represented a time period earlier than that. As a sort of a gold standard of quote unquote elevated speech. It made so much sense for her to speak in that.
Absolutely. And it makes me think of like the transatlantic accent is kind of the thing that comes to mind of everyone in early picture days kind of having a that sort of put upon almost British, but not quite
Not quite, but close.
close enough.
That's exactly kind of what I wanted to do is I knew that what she was going to sound like. I kind of, I think I intuited that.
Sure.
And then there's all this travel around the world. And I'm an accent coach. I mean, I coach in conservatories. I'm teaching the grad students at UCSD, the British
Wow.
dialect now, their RP work. And so I've actually just done an entire romance in RP. And I really borrow from Judi Dench because it was written in the 70s, but it's situated in this, it's set in the 1700s. And so the way that Judi Dench speaks, I thought would be more representative of the time. So
I
I
could see that.
borrow, I definitely borrow. If you want to do something like that, you're going to go to Judi Dench or Ian McKellen. You're not going to go to Cumberbatch as your example necessarily.
No, I don't think he's your best example, no.
So it's the same thing for this book. I wanted to make sure that there was a sound and that it did not sound like now. It did not sound contemporary. The other thing is necessity. Here's this woman, this black woman passing as white. And if people find out, she could lose everything and be harmed. And I've done other pieces, just did another one recently about, and I'm going to have to find the title because it's slipping away from me, about a very, very famous madam in Manhattan during the same time. And at her trial, who shows up in the courtroom? Belle DaCosta Green. And they have a look at each other because they're both passing. So there
So
she is on the
they're
stand.
sharing that moment of, I know, you know.
I think, am I right? I think I'm right. They have this, and it's just comes and kind of goes. But
Interesting.
that same, there were a lot of people who were able to pass as white,
Sure.
and economically for opportunity, they decided they were going to seize the reins of that. And it must have been such a mind bender to walk around looking one way and having and knowing that anybody who knew that you had something else in there would completely reject you for that thing. I cannot even imagine.
The conversation around passing is so fraught and still exists in so many different aspects of our world today. But I mean, no matter what, it all still kind of maintains an element of danger.
And the parallels to today, right now, straight passing or cis passing
Absolutely.
is an absolute parallel. There's just, and it's fraught with danger. You just don't know who you're amongst, and what that would be. And it does come up actually in the other book, which I'm going to have to look the title up now because I do so much that when I'm finished, I sort of go, oh God, all right, what do I do next? What do I start prepping? What do I got to start reading now?
Also, the sheer timing of the fact that both of these women and similar situations kind of showing up in your life. How often do you find that the books that you have this situation where you're going from one time period to another? I know you kind of tread these grounds a lot, but do you find many situations like this where, you feel like another character could just stroll into the courtroom?
Oh, I feel like they should, and they don't, which is disappointing.
We do all
But
want that
I
cinematic
know.
universe, right?
We do, we do. I don't, I do have overlaps, and it always makes me smile. It always makes me feel like I can create a richer performance
Of
because
course.
anything that's embedded in one book, when it's located in like a place and a time, I just did The Moon and the Mars. It's Kia Corthran, who is a playwright, has written this massive, wonderful historical piece about a little girl growing up in Manhattan in the Five Points neighborhood and the environs, which is where not just black folks, like during the Civil War era, not just they lived there, but also all those Irish immigrants and German immigrants. And so we have all these kids running around with accents. But the
And the
time
thought of
period,
that.
yeah, the time period again gave birth to, and she's also a biracial kid because her dad is black and her father dies and her mom's Irish and the mom dies. And so she's raised by the two grandmothers. So she's
Oh,
always running back and
wow.
forth between each set of relatives, which of course have very different speech patterns.
Oh, that just blew my mind. And you're doing all of those speech. I'm connecting the dots of like, you're doing all of those speech patterns. Now, I've seen you effortlessly throw an accent in our conversation here, but what is that like to have to, do you plan all of your character lines kind of at once? Would you say go through kind of one grandmother first and kind of record her portion of the story? And then after she's out of your head, switch over to like the Irish granny. So you have a, so you don't have to go between, or do you just put yourself through that and go?
It's a serious chronological journey. It's okay. This page to the next page to the next page. And I do teach a fair amount. I'm just starting to teach audiobooks now at Pace. I've been teaching at UDSD, wow. Learning Ally. I've done a training thing for them. But what I usually tell my students is that you take your acting technique, which is, you know, I'm going to play this action, right? I'm going to, like an arrow, I'm going to shoot it like an arrow, and I've got this target, and it's the other person, and I'm acting with them. What you have to do is whatever it is that you want, that you're going for, you have to release it completely. It's like letting the arrow go from the bow. Let it all go. Don't hold on to any of the flockings. Don't try it. Let it go. And then pick up the bow and arrow of the other character. So you can do that cleanly without two sets of I want this and I want that. Just right. Let it go, drop it. Or the metaphor I use most often is it's like playing tennis with yourself, mm-hmm. which of course is impossible, but yes. It's like playing tennis with yourself where you have your racket, right? And that's your swing is your the action that you're playing. And you swing it and you hit the ball and you drop the racket. You run to the other side. You pick up the other racket and you receive from yourself.
Right.
But if you try to bring the baggage from one side of the net with you to the other, that's what gets in your way. You just have to release really cleanly, let it all go. It's not in your body anymore. And now you're ready to pick up the next thing.
Wow. Now that is such a fascinating thought that, right.
Totally, it's totally mental. It's totally mental.
I mean, yes, but it makes it work.
Somehow it does. So that was really interesting for me because you've got these families, and the Irish family has come over. They'd all be related. They'd be from most likely the same place. So I'm not doing like a lot of Northern Ireland, Southern, sure. You know, kind of regional things really. But you do have people who are literally just coming over, and those have been there for a decade. And then you also have the Black family members living in New York. And if they didn't grow up in the South, there's really no reason to give them any kind of typical Black Southern dialect necessarily. Right. What I've discovered in my travels, and we don't have recordings from that era per se, so mm-hmm. is that when you look at, I think that's how they do this with Shakespeare too, when you look at poetry and the rhyming scheme in poetry, mm-hmm. you can tell how a word might have been spoken because it's used to rhyme with another word. Sure. And it might not be said that way anymore, but it used to be. So sometimes you get a little tip off there. But there are so many Northern Blacks and Midwestern Blacks that came up from the South, had kids, and then the kids grew up with their, you know, more of a Midwestern or Northeastern sensibility in their speech. And we all code switch. When you're with Grandma and Grandpa in Alabama, you learn how to speak in such a way that people there understand what it is you mean, and you know, and don't get offended because you know where, you know, not to step.
Absolutely.
But code switching. I do that with my Jamaican relatives all the time. I have a YouTube video that I use in my class of a guy from Appalachia, and you know, you think of Appalachia and the locus of the sounds like very, very far, sort of back in the mouth into the throat. And you don't comb your hair, you comb your her.
Right.
If you go for that real pure sound, the R's are really reflex. I found this guy, I've given out an interview. And he, again, I play stuff like that for my students. I'm like, remember, there are stereotypes and you don't like when it's done to you. So don't do it to your characters.
Absolutely.
Unless your character has a walk on, you know, like if you have a character who's got a walk on.
Right. If you are playing that one bit, it's time to steal the scene. Absolutely.
Totally. Yeah. My bit characters oftentimes will have less of a fully fleshed out character because there's not enough text for them to be fleshed out.
Right. You're just
You
trying
know?
to sell the that moment of, oh, sorry, I just walked in here and now I will take over this stage and then I will walk off and you'll think of me for the rest of the night, but you will never see me again.
Exactly. So rather than have them compete for center stage with the main characters, if they're just functionary, that's fine. I can have a functionary character and have just, you know, sort of straight up sound like that. Although
it's so interesting.
It is hard for me not to. I don't like to do stereotypes, period. Mm-hmm. And I think that the thing that sets apart an archetype from a stereotype is one is human, complicated, complex. They listen, and the thing that they say comes right from what they just received.
Absolutely.
Whereas a stereotype sort of has a set track that it's in. And
right.
you can blow on them as much as you want. They're not going to cool off or fall out of the track.
Right. They're going to hit the same points every time. It's that.
Yeah.
You know,
it's like McDonald's.
It's kind of, yeah.
Like a McDonald's burger. The same. There you go. Yeah. So I try really hard not to do that. I tend to cast my books diversely. And I mean that truly all across the board. I was working on N.K. Jemisin's The Fifth Season, the trilogy.
Yes.
Won the Hugo Award 3 years running.
Beautiful. Beautiful series.
Beautiful. Just, I want to go back and record it over and over and over and over again. You know? Because the experience of being in it and walking through it as the performer gave me so much in return.
Ah.
I cast that to reflect voices in the world. Mm-hmm. So two of the characters in one of the communities, they call them comms, you know, in the book, the woman who's the comm leader is Nigerian. Mm-hmm. I give her a Nigerian accent. And her wife, I think it's her wife in the book, is Swedish. Or Norwegian, really, because I don't necessarily do Swedish. Norwegian is one I'm more familiar with.
Okay.
And then there's like the smartest person in the book, the smartest scientist in the book is this character who starts out as this, she's a little girl when we see her, I guess it is. And then we don't see her. I don't want to talk about too much because I'll give a spoiler. I don't want to do
it's
that.
It's okay. You can be, it's okay. You're so far so good.
Okay. Yeah. You tell me, I don't want to like, okay. But this character is trans. I had to learn it in the book because you don't know it at first. You find out later.
Right.
But what I found so interesting about it was here was this wickedly smart science person. Mm-hmm. And I decided I was going to make them basically from like the hill country. Because the stereotype is, oh, these people sound like this. They're dumb. And I went, nope, not doing that. Not having it.
We can break it. Yeah.
We can break them. They've been made. They can be broken.
Mm-hmm.
And I got the loveliest thank you note from a scientist from Appalachia who said, thank you for not doing that. Thank you for choosing that voice for her.
Mm-hmm.
And so, yes, my little diversity project there.
I think that's beautiful. Representation matters.
I make that a big portion of when I'm teaching. I tend to show my kids like TED Talks of brilliant people with local dialects so that they don't associate a local country type of dialect or rural dialect
right.
with stupidity. That's wrong. Absolutely wrong.
It's so interesting, especially knowing that some of your teaching is done in New York, all of the different places where they are kind of hubs of people coming from elsewhere, that we're all kind of touched by this element of certain voices just mean different things.
So I'm up performing at the Huntington in two Euripides plays, the Iphigenia cycle. So we're up there performing. We had really interesting experiences. The first one being the press comes while we're in rehearsal. We have, you know, we have our TV star that's, you know, in one of the slotted positions. Of course, they want to come. He's on a current thing. And they want to come and interview him and they want to interview the director. And The first question out of their mouth was, "Your cast is just people from all over, just so many different races. We had like Asian actors, I had a Hawaiian actor, we had black actors, light skin, dark skin, straight, queer, everything.
Right.
How does everybody get along?" And they asked that question as if because we had these differences, we would never be able to like socialize.
Oh, wow.
And the people at the theater were just laughing because they said we were the closest knit cast they had in years.
Sure.
We went out to the bar together afterwards. There was a bar where you'd go in and get board games. So we'd get backgammon and stuff and we'd go after and talk and play games.
Right.
But we did so much together. So much together. And the assumption was because we were from these different backgrounds, it must be dicey. No, not at all.
Wow. Because we're all different, it must be real rough to work together. That's fascinating.
Yeah, it was just the assumption. Now, truth be told, at night, now this was in, oh, goodness, I'm going to date myself now. This was in the 90s.
Okay.
Maybe 90. Maybe 1990.
Okay.
Close. I know it's close around there. What we did have to do, and this is unfortunately a reflection of place and time. Mm-hmm. When the black actors came out of the theater, the white actors had to hail a cab, open the door and let us get in.
Oh,
because they
wow.
didn't necessarily stop for us to pick us up in front of the theater.
Sure.
They drive on by. So, but again, we were tight knit enough with the white actors to look, I got this.
You're like, don't you worry.
Yeah. It was really something.
Huh. It's so silly that people who haven't ever been involved in theater don't seem to understand that, like, oh no, you're going to meet a lot of different folks. And whether you love all of them or hate some of them, you're still a family for this run of time, even if it's just that production, even if they're like that cousin that you sometimes don't get along with, you still have to make the show work. So
yeah, well, it's the whole is supposed to be greater than the sum of its parts.
Absolutely.
We're supposed to all be sacrificed for the sake of the thing we're all putting energy into.
Right.
Which, could you think of a better lesson in democracy?
The whole is supposed to be greater than the sum of its parts.
I
wonder if anyone's ever heard that.
I don't know.
What do we know, right?
Yeah, really. So it's been a quite, I love historical fiction. I love doing speculative fiction as well, just because I think both things, if you think about them under the guise of Afrofuturism, because I think that's actually a good lens through which to process it. If you're doing historical fiction, you're looking backwards.
Mm-hmm.
You're looking at the steps that were taken that got us to where we are now. And there's so much that you can learn from those steps. You can learn where a misstep happened. And now when you turn forward, I'm not stepping in that poo. I saw that when I was looking backwards, how that goes.
Right.
So historical fiction for me gives us that opportunity to look back and see what went on. I am very, very clear about things I don't want ever to happen again. I may not be able to stop them, but I know where I would like to put my efforts.
Absolutely.
And then when you think of speculative fiction, it's just a pivot on one's heels. Now I'm looking down a path of possibility that hasn't happened. But mm-hmm. if I shine the light down, it's like The Handmaid's Tale.
Right.
It's a giant, well, what if? Well, what if? And I look down that path. And it becomes a cautionary tale.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if you learn to spin that forward, that's what these writers are so good at doing.
Absolutely.
I think it's Kim Stanley Robinson that wrote 2140. You know, it starts out in New York City and the streets are now underwater. People get around in boats because the polar ice caps have melted. And we are a sea level city. He's one of the more brilliant people that went, okay, so if this happens, what are the steps mankind would have to take to continue to survive? David Brin is, I think, a little bit like that too. Very speculative. How would this come about? And if it did, what would it be like? You know, that first contact, he wrote that 600-page book, Existence, which is just wow. all of N.K. Jemisin's work, and Nnedi Okorafor, and many other people, and even, I mean, to a certain degree, the looking back and the looking forward, there's so many people I don't even know who to speak of next, but that idea that they are inextricably linked, those who look back and those who look forward. There's this little juncture right in the middle where you can, again, like pivot on your heels back or forward. So I tend to get pretty fascinated by that. But I'm sure you can figure I'm a Star Trek lover.
You know, that wouldn't surprise me.
And Doctor Who, you know,
I mean,
just that notion.
Are you excited for the 60th? I'm so excited.
I actually have some catch up watching to do.
Me too. I fell off the wagon for a bit there. You know, but to know that they're the ones coming back.
Yes. I was halfway through Capaldi's season. And then life just got so busy.
I honestly think that's about where I had to pause as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That right. Yeah. Life happens. Sometimes I caught it much later as things were kind of happening on his end. So I had to like pick up so much that at some point you burn yourself out a little bit.
Yeah. That's kind of what happened, because I went full bore on them. And then when the reboot of the reboot, you know, there was like when the Capaldi, as soon as it started again, I went, oh my goodness, I got to go back and watch it from the beginning again. And I do think I got a little bit burned out.
I think it's natural.
I will say, and I forgot to say this earlier, I don't know if you're aware of the other book about Belle de Costigan.
No, but I'd love to be aware of it.
I love it. There is another book called, it's a nonfiction book, An Illuminated Life. It's Belle de Costigan's Journey from Prejudice to Privilege. It's by Heidi Ardizione. I think it's Dizione.
Perfect.
Or Dizione. I'm not sure. But she wrote the scholar text on Belle de Costigan. And I don't know how I got so lucky, but I got to do both. So a lot of the research from one kind of carried over to another. And then the other thing is, I knew little bits and pieces about the second book because I had read the first. And then I ended up getting, okay, so this is the factual. All right, that's where they speculated. Okay, I was really able to look at her life in a kind of 360 degree way. That was so cool.
That's beautiful. Just being able to envelop yourself in a person who is so prolific, both in the real and in the imagined.
Yeah, yeah. I count myself lucky beyond words that I read and people pay me to do that. Just even if I were just reading and I'd tell you what the book was about, like in the corner somewhere, and you went and did something with it, that would be pretty cool. But the idea that I get to perform the books and really delve deeply into the characters is there's nothing like this. And you know what's happening now too is, audiobook narrators are getting together because we're starting to realize we're this funky group of people, right?
Yeah.
We're basically like we're a bunch of actors who love to read, and we don't have a desperate need to be looked at.
Right.
You know? So it's okay that we do this thing that's not in front of your eyes.
Right.
And it also takes a specific skill set to do this. And you know, this is a big conversation right now because with technology, a lot of companies are trying to bring AI in to record books.
Interesting.
And I've been listening to AI. It's not it's not your AI that sounds like this anymore. It's not that anymore. It's gotten more sophisticated. But when you listen to it, I mean, I can tell in 30 seconds whether it's human or not, even though it's very connected and the speech is really flowy. The thing that AI can't do ever is play actions. It can play emotions because I've heard AI.
You can program them in, sure.
You can program, oh, this is sadness, this is melancholy, this is anger, this is happiness, this is, you know, ebullience, whatever. You can get general categories of emotions because the actor is going to record that and you'll have the little pocket of variety. But What happens when you have irony? What happens when someone says in the text, "Oh, I just love it when you do that," and we know from the context that it's, "Oh, I just love it when you do that." So it plays
Right.
exactly against the meaning.
Absolutely.
Or
And
someone says, "I just hate it when you do that," and it's a seduction scene. "Ooh, I just hate it when you do that." Obviously, it's not what the face value of it is.
Exactly. And
So.
no matter how sophisticated they get, there is a level of human experience that has to still exist. I greatly appreciate the changes and updates to AI for the benefit of people using screen readers, for accessibility
Right.
services. Like you said, it's
Yeah.
actors who want to put energy into it. And I think the danger of AI getting involved is that I have friends who they know I love audiobooks, and they'll be like, "But I don't want someone to read to me. I don't want it to just sound like it flat across the board." I'm like, "No, you need to pick one up and listen to it, because it's not just someone reading for you. It's someone reading to you. It's an
To you. Yeah.
experience."
I mean, core thing, first lesson, intimacy, that this is an intimate act. And, because we're Americans, we go right to intimate, naked. No,
Right,
no, no.
scared right away.
Right. We're not talking about the naked kind. We're talking about the I'm driving in my car, I'm sitting next to you, we're close friends, and I'm telling you all about how my relationship broke up. Or how much something hurt me when somebody died. That kind of intimacy, heart intimacy, and head thought and feeling intimacy, not flesh. Although we do have erotica, and that has a place too.
Yes, there are those types of intimate readings as well, but across the board, yeah, it's a piece about vulnerability. It's like you said, letting someone in. I especially now, that's how I get my chores done. I love to think that I have chores. It's only me imposing them, but to know that I have to do the laundry. Well, now I have a friend who's going to go do the laundry
Be
with
with
me.
you, yes.
Exactly. And if it feels otherwise, it's not as enjoyable. It's not an experience.
I'm so glad that you said that. That's always my goal. I feel like I'm always reaching out through the ether to touch.
Yes.
And sometimes I literally it's literally physically in my body, because I sit in my little booth. I have tiny little booths. I guess like my booth here in New York is about I have about that much space.
Past your
What's that?
shoulder.
Two inches off each shoulder.
Oh,
And
gosh.
I got a little pedestal chair, so it's round, because I can't even fit a regular chair in there. And I sit on it and I just lean back up against the wall, or I lean to the side because it's 2 inches. And
Not much more space.
I have just enough length to go from my hip at the back with my leg stuck out into the door jamb, because it was a closet. That's
Good
all I've
use of a
got.
closet.
Yep.
I mean, but I think that also puts you into the mental element of, once again, that intimacy. You are record it must feel like you're recording for a friend. It's going to be sent out to people who are going to welcome you into their lives.
I literally sit forward and I speak into the mic, but I always have like a little bit of a lean. It's the same way I would sit if I were talking to you and we were in a bar and it was a little bit loud, but I wanted you to hear
Whispering
what I
into
was
the ear,
saying.
yeah.
And I don't want to whisper necessarily, because then I'll be too low in the mix, but that idea that I want you to hear, but I don't want the whole room to hear me.
Absolutely.
That's my Irish pub analogy. It's got to be an Irish pub, because it's the best place in the world to go after work, right? And so you go to the pub and you're sitting there at a little round table and you're in your chair and your friend comes in, right? And you're sitting there and you each have your Bass Ale. And the whole place is full of people doing the same thing. And you lean in, right? And you have your private conversation over your Bass Ale. And I do love Bass Ale, that's true. So I always sort of describe it like that. I was like, look, you've done that. Just
Right.
think about that intimate talking that you do, and that feeling of letting down after work and being able to connect with someone that you feel a connection to.
Right.
And good narrators make that happen in the work.
Yes,
I just
absolutely.
don't see AI quite getting there. I think you're going to get mood. You're going to get mood. You're not going to get nuance.
Right. There will never be nuance with AI, but there will be programming that'll allow some of it, sure. But like I said, I prefer it in the accessibility sense compared to.
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. There's a lot of things out there. If we could make everything available, that would be great. But I will say, a lot of people also argue that, oh, it's just going to be for nonfiction. But you know what? Nonfiction writers often have a thesis. They have a premise that they're putting into their work that they've researched for sometimes years just to write this book. And a lot of what they write dovetails back into flowing out from that thesis. And the human can recognize what that is and then begin to, oh, this is a sentence that supports this connection to the thesis. It's not just narrative and storytelling. And then again, all right, let me just, the words are barely out of my mouth. There's a lot of nonfiction that is narrativized. I've done a couple of books that were so amazing. One about a young anthropologist. She's the granddaughter of one of the like Hidden Figures women at Bletchley Park in England.
Okay.
And so she's like a cave drawing, spelunking anthropologist. And she describes like going to Spain, getting off, seeing the valley, going down to the, where the rock caves are, sliding in and getting in and then coming into an inner chamber. And it's like listening to a politically correct Indiana Jones, you know, not a grave robber, right? Not there to like rob this, you know, a culture, but to look, to learn about what were early humans doing. What did the cave paintings tell us? Completely narrativized. It sounds almost like an Indiana Jones kind of a thing. And she went all over the world doing this. So yeah, that's not one I'd put on AI.
I also wouldn't put that on AI. I think of, there are so many genres that exist in the world of books because we all have different tastes. And there are people who want nonfiction for enjoyment, just like those of us who want, you know, YA fantasy for their enjoyment. Like, why should anyone be at a loss for their experience? It's at the end of the day, it's an experience, whether you're trying to learn from it. I shouldn't have to feel like I'm sitting in the most dull lecture I've ever been in just because I want nonfiction.
I can't remember her name. I ran into a woman, it was at one of the Audies years ago, the Audie Awards or the audiobook awards. She's from Australia and we were in a session during the day before the awards. And she said she was doing a study in Australia on learning patterns, how people learn. Some people are visual learners. Some people are auditory learners. And that's where they retain more. And so what she was also studying was, how does one use the voice in such a way that facts that come across the page become more memorable? And I was like, I do this all the time. And I lost touch with this woman. I'm so disappointed. But so you're doing nonfiction. And if something is organized, like the writing, you know, like just essay structure is chronological. They're date anchors. I remember doing a piece on Seabiscuit, the horse, which I now use in my teaching to teach this particular thing. We're talking about what was happening in 1921, 1924, by 1928. And so you use the voice to land on a number, and it could be the 8, it could be the 28 or 1928, depending on what you're comparing, so that the ear actually catches the comparison of the two dates. And it's easier to feel the interval from the thing that happened just last. So if it's 1964 and information. By 1968, I really feel that's a 4-year gap because I heard 4 and now I hear 8.
I mean, truly, when you did that, my brain immediately knew to fall in line. When you just said 1928, I went, oh, okay, start listening. Here's the day. It triggers something. Absolutely.
I use a higher tone in my voice and then I anchor them as they come up so that there's a sense of, it almost creates a visual in your head. But that's chronological. And you know, you can do that with process-oriented things. If you were doing a cookbook, you could you have to use your voice to detail the process, or you know, it would be a disaster, I think. The same thing, are you just doing something, are you reading about a cause and effect, a causal relationship? So these things are the causes, and then you talk about their effect so that they feel like they're on different sides of something. And
Absolutely.
the ear remembers that this was sonically here, this was sonically there. So I think you absolutely can enhance recall by using the voice in a certain way. It's really a collective unconscious kind of thing. I've noticed right now that we're in this very interesting Black and Irish beat. So Kia Corthran, playwright, just did The Moon and the Mars. She's a well-known playwright, and she wrote a really long book about this whole period and this relationship between these two communities. There's another book, Dreaming in Irish. It's not historical fiction, it's sort of the now, but you've got Dreaming in Irish is by Sarah Jane McKenna. And truth be told, the Beth Mannion, the writer, is a bestie of mine from fifth grade. She just wrote a book about an Irish family in New York, finding out about their roots and how they came over and what happened. And so she has to go back to Ireland to go again. That idea of roots and these two communities somehow paralleling, because those two communities were also brought into conflict over and over again, and the draft riots in New York. And yet their lived experiences again had so much similarity, surviving through poverty. The song No Irish Need Apply, which was a horrible thing to do to a group of people. It just wouldn't hire them. We don't want your kind here. We African Americans know what that's like. And so there's that parallelism, and also Paradise, what's it called? Paradise Square, the musical. And that sort of, I think, I've been looking at some footage online. There's a whole focus on Irish dance, river dancing, and African American tap dancing, and how they owe each other a little something.
That is really
So I
fascinating.
do feel like we're in a beat right now where this seems to be something that's on our minds. I'm not quite sure why, but there are people writing about it. But it feels like there's at least an edge of people trying to go back and look at that. Like, how did
How did
we
we
fall
get
out? How did
here?
we get here? Really important to do. And I'm also seeing it too in the queer community, which is making me very happy. I went to a lecture at a Riverside Church, actually, up here in Harlem. It's right near Columbia University, and there were two speakers: Joan Rader, who's a showrunner in Hollywood, and she speaks at churches. They're a Catholic family, and they have an adopted daughter, and they've got a trans son, and they talk a lot at religious places about how it's really easy to love your trans kid. It really is. It's not hard.
Absolutely.
And they're just like any other kid. They just want to be happy. They just want to play. They want to know who they are. And so there was another speaker. I went to hear Joan, but I also I'm very remiss. I cannot remember the young person's name. They gave an amazing history of from like the 1500s to the present, sexual variations and orientations through the ages. And what happened when cultures that had that as part of the culture came across colonizers, and also religious groups would come to a place and want to convert to Christianity. But to do that, the wise people, the wise ones of that culture, were often the queer ones. They were gay, they were lesbian, they were trans, they were dual binary, non-binary. And because of that two-ness that they had, just almost like Native American two spirits, because of that two-ness, they were considered having dual perspective, therefore wiser than the rest of us. And the only way a priest could supplant that was to demonize and outlaw it using religion. And they needed to steal the thunder, the fire, the wisdom fire from those groups of people. And so he goes through, he's got names of people in history, and places and cultures. And it's fascinating. It scares the bejesus out of people. It's scaring people crazy, and they're doing very reactionary things. And I don't know what the answer to that is, except having really, really big barbecues.
Now I can support that. I would love a really, really big
Even if it's
barbecue.
barbecue with lots of people, I always think it's sitting down to break bread with people is what creates
Community.
ritual and food. Yeah.
Absolutely. I think nothing builds community better than the chance to share food.
So I'm gonna look for your big barbecue coming up. That's what I'm gonna do.
Now I guess I have to plan one. I think my horoscope told me I needed to throw a party. Now you've told me I need to have a barbecue. I guess I'll combine them
There
together.
you go. Let me know if you want to come out to Hawaii. You'll come down my place and then we'll make you some barbecue.
Oh, like I need a different reason to come to Hawaii. Anytime, I'll find a ticket.
Absolutely.
Well, Robin, before I let you go, because I could talk to you all day, truly and honestly. Where can the listeners find you online and anything coming up that you'd like to promote?
Wow. The one thing I really want to promote, I can't talk about yet. I won't
Okay,
be able
that's
to talk
fair.
till August. But
We can talk about it. We can meet again in August and talk about it
I just I had a conversation with the person building my new website because I built my old website and it looks like I built my website. So, but I actually have a company called voxpertise.com, which is VOXpertise.
Love
I make stuff up when there's not a word that's available. So that's where you'll generally find me. And I'm hoping to start to put stuff up there. But you can find me. Just Google my name, I'll come up wherever you can find me. Because I'm pretty much, I've done a lot of books, they're out there. And I try and advocate for other narrators a lot. I love to do these talks like we just did.
Yes.
Just because I think that if you're a kid and you're grown up and you haven't encountered audiobooks yet, your life is going to be richer if I can help open the door, if I can even make you curious about it. Like, okay,
Right.
great. If you can get an audiobook of that book that you need to read, that biography for your history class, I'm going to guess that you're just sit down with a highlighter, let somebody read it and just highlight it as you listen. You're going to retain more. I'm also going to let you know quickly that you can go to that young teens like 13 and above can go to Audiobook Sync and sign up for free books for the whole summer. It's like you have 1 week to download two titles, and they're curated, so there's usually a relationship between the two titles. All you have to do is go sign up, put your email in, they'll send you a little link, and you download it.
Well, Robin, thank you so much for joining me
My
today
pleasure,
and
Joe.
for talking about your passion.
Woohoo! My pleasure.
Readers can sample and borrow the titles mentioned in today's episode on overdrive.com, and our library friends can purchase these titles in Marketplace. Professional Book Nerds is proud to be an Evergreen Podcast signature program. To learn about other Evergreen podcasts, visit evergreenpodcast.com. Our podcast is produced, recorded, and edited by Emma Dwyer, Jill Grunewald, and Joe Skelly, and presented by Overdrive. To learn more, visit professionalbooknerds.com.
The following is a high five moment from highfivecasino.com.
Welcome to Burger Yippee. Would you like a hot apple pie today?
Yes, yes, yeah, I won! Woohoo!
So that's a yes on the apple pie?
I just went big time playing High Five Casino on my phone. Real cash prizes, free daily rewards, over 1,200 games. Yeah!
So yes or no on the apple pie?
Woo! I won again!
I'll take that as a yes. Drive around.
Have you had your high five moment today? Only at highfivecasino.com.
High Five Casino is a social casino. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited. Play responsibly. Conditions apply. See website for details.
High Five Casino.